Hi, I'm David Astle, host of Evenings on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, and I want to bring you a slice of a chat that I had with comedian and writer Tony Martin. And this was on the back of the news of Martin Molloy's induction into the Sounds of Australia as part of the National Film and Sound Archives.
The whole thing was, like, I describe it to younger friends now, and they don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm saying there was no internet. We would have to get the newspapers, because it was a national show, we'd have to get all the newspapers delivered from around the country to our shed on the top of the building in St Kilda. And then we'd start at 10 in the morning, and we'd have to try and read every paper before 4 o'clock and have sketches and things recorded. And the sketches were very elaborate, but we didn't have the sort of computer technology that we have now. It was all analog, and things would have to be mastered onto quarter-inch tape. And I remember often we would still be mixing down a sketch as the show was starting. So we would have like a 3-minute sketch, and there would be a 4-minute song would be on, and we'd be mixing it, going like the song would be fading, and we'd still be mastering the sketch. I remember on a couple of occasions I would have to have boards set up on the floor of the studio so that I could do live footsteps for a sketch, because we hadn't had time to add footsteps that were needed. It was bizarre.
It was bizarre. In fact, we've got Tasmania on board tonight too. Big shout out to Tasmania. Going national, as the show was, through 54 radio stations across the country, Tony, how did you manage to kind of get that balance right? It's tough enough to make comedy. It's even harder to make comedy that's funny right across this continent. How did you kind of get that balance right?
Well, we had done breakfast radio for 5 years. And, of course, when you do breakfast, you've got to really do, whatever the big story is of that day. People want local news and they want the big stories to be covered. But in the afternoon, no one had really done that kind of show and drive. And we would just make whatever made us laugh the main story of the day. So like there would be, I think I remember something like, I think the day Princess Diana was killed, our main story was that Robert Downey Jr. had been arrested and claimed to the arresting officers that he was covered in imaginary rats. So that was our main story for the day.
Well, I think you've got to, don't bury the lead, as they say. You've got to lead with your gold.
And you just go, okay, that's got to work all around the country. But Tasmania was interesting because we, perhaps a lot of people who are listening to this would remember, we were actually kind of shamefully taken off air in Tasmania.
What did you do wrong?
There was a big article in the paper that we would, the headline was "Duo Who Bagged Tasmania Ripped Off the Air." And we're going, we hadn't bagged Tasmania at all. We were completely baffled. And later, about 2 weeks later, someone who'd left the station and moved to another station on the Gold Coast called us up and said that it was because we had been making a lot of jokes about, remember Senator Brian Harradine?
I do remember Senator Harradine.
And he had a lot of, fans, obviously, in Tasmania, and a lot of local retailers were so furious about our jokes that they told the station they would pull their ads unless our show was taken off here. So they concocted this story that we had slagged Tasmania. But this is how great the Martin Molloy fans were in the previous, prior to the internet era. Some students worked out that in Tasmania you could still pick up our station via a station on the coast of Victoria.
Pirate radio.
So they made these huge posters and super glued them all over the fronts of the windows of the shops that had us taken off air, including a large department store, saying, tune your radio to this number and you can still hear Martin Molloy. The great thing about that story is that shortly after that happened, I married into Brian Harradine's family.
Are you serious?
I did.
Knowingly?
No, it was a complete, I didn't know it at all. I married someone whose brother's wife was, I think, a niece of Brian Harradine. So I remember thinking, try and have me axed from your family. Although I did divorce several years later, so he did have the last laugh.
Gag duo ratbag marries into Taz royalty. I can see the headlines. Tony, one of the joys of radio, it seemed to be one of the hypnotising joys for you, this idea that the whole wonders of comedy and imagination and story is pretty much happening between the walls of your cranium.
That's right. Theatre of the mind is the most common phrase. And we used to, I mean, I'm very influenced by a man who obviously older listeners would know, Kenny Everett. And he in the 70s used to make a lot of use of stereo on radio, and he apparently would do things like, if there was really bad news that day, he would only play the news in the left speaker and he would play soothing music in the right speaker so you could pan your stereo over and just hear the music. And so we had things like, I remember we tried, there's a way of creating fake quadraphonic using stereo. And I remember we once had Pete Smith roller skating around your car. If you were listening in your car and you turned, it sounded like he was going around all four speakers. We spent a lot of time doing things like that.
A meter mate. In fact, you mentioned that 87 was the first time that you created the John Howard character. I think was that the same romantic year that you bumped into to Mick as part of the breakfast team with the DJ?
Well, it actually, yeah, because all of the guys in the D-Generation X, I was from New Zealand, but mm-hmm. the rest of them all were famously from the Melbourne Uni Reviews. And so after the D-Generation became a hit TV show, they were sort of called back to, see the latest review and sort of sit in the royal box. And I remember we went along in 87 to see a show called, it was bizarre, you know, they always have terrible names, Uni Reviews,
oh, yeah.
Let's be honest. It was called Laminex on the Rocks. And it was a three-hour show, and it was pretty bad, I thought. And Mick Molloy was right up the back. He didn't have a lot to do. And the show went on the road for about 8 months and toured round, and then we had to go and see it again. Oh. And it was like, oh, do we want to see that show again? It was on at St. Martin's in South Yarra. And we went and saw it, and they had one of the actors had left, and Mick Molloy and Jason Stevens had completely written the show and got in a professional director, and it was sensational. It was like a really great show, and that was where I really know. I don't think I'd noticed Mick the first time I'd seen him, and he was really good at stealing every scene he was in by doing less than everyone else.
He was also good at redeeming absolute bilge. So maybe that was the love at first sight.
Well, he had every sort of. I remember thinking he was like a combination of Bill Murray and John Belushi. It was like those two people in one body.
And Sean McAuliffe actually has identified you two as being different blokes with an identical sense of humour. Is that true? Do you reckon there's actually truth in that observation?
There was. I do remember we had, yes, that's true. We were very different people, and, you know, you know what Mick Molloy's like.
He's so not like you.
It's not really a character he's playing, and you know, I am the video shop nerd. But we were the sort of people who would go and see the same film separately and then list our 10 favourite funny bits, and it would always be the same. We had very identical senses of humour.
You mentioned that you New Zealand born and bred, and I understand it was it Hauraki Radio that you got your first break on radio?
Radio Hauraki.
Hauraki. How did that happen?
Radio Hauraki was a kind of a pirate station. I didn't actually work there. What happened was in 83... there was the very first FM radio station began in New Zealand, which was in Auckland. It was called 89 FM, and they poached a lot of the famous Radio Hauraki staff, including a man called Fred Boddicker, who's probably the most famous radio man in Perth to this day. Mm-hmm. And I was working at an ad agency, writing radio ads, actually, and doing a lot of the voices for them. And the guy whose job I had taken moved across the road to this radio station. He would get me across in the lunch hour to do silly voices in the ads he was writing, and that just got me in the door. And then I just got into radio as I got a job at another FM station down in Hamilton, which is where I'd grown up in New Zealand, and I had to write 120 radio ads a week. That was my job, and do like a lot of the voices for them.
And also, too, I would imagine being, all a factotum, essentially, doing so many tasks, it would have actually made you a very valuable player when you did come across to Brisbane in, what was it?
That was in 85.
Yeah. What were you doing in Brisbane?
Well, it was. I was doing the same thing because we in Hamilton, our sister station was FM 104, which is now Triple M in Brisbane, and their copywriter quit, and I remember the head of the station just happened to be visiting Hamilton that week, and he just said, "Have you got anyone here who can go over?"
So you basically were match made there as part of you, the fat man, Mick, met up with Mick Molloy of Mick Serve there on the G Generation.
That's right. I was 1987. For people listening, they'll be momentarily confused. I was known as the fat man. That's right.
And then it was Bull Twang, which was that Triple M experiment that really saw the chemistry tested. What did you learn from that early partnership on air with you and Mick working together?
Well, we on the breakfast show, I was sort of teamed up with Tom Gleisner, we were Tommy G and the Fat Man. And because it's a very complicated thing to explain, but it's like comedy is like a marriage, and you have a series of marriages and within a comedy group. So really, Jason Stevens and Mick Molloy were a couple, and me and Tom Gleisner were a couple. And so, but I loved doing stuff with Mick, and we had done pilots for The Late Show at Channel 9 in 1990, right, 2 years before it got up on the ABC. And Mick and I had done a lot of work together in that pilot, and we really wanted to do more stuff together. So it was like we were cheating on our partners within the group.
It's a bit grubby.
So we got a Sunday night show. And also we wanted to do longer segments. In breakfast radio, the segments were very short. We wanted to do much longer stuff. So we got a show on Sunday nights called Bull Twang, which was like an early version of Martin Molloy. It was on in 1990. And we also had Pete Smith being the voiceover man. So it was very much a prototype of Martin Molloy.
In fact, I'm trying to wonder, Tony, because I'm thinking for anyone with an ear for what radio could be, hearing you two with Pete Smith in cahoots back then in 1990, I'm wondering what was it about that sort of four-year period that it needed to be 4 years, in fact, before the green light happened at the Oz Stereo Network with Fox 1995 to 1998, Martin Molloy. What was happening in between those?
Well, it was a strange period because we had done five pilots, believe it or not, mm-hmm. for The Late Show at Channel 9, and Kerry Packer didn't like it, didn't think it was going to work, and so we took it to the ABC. That's right. This is crazy. We took it to the ABC at the end of 1990, and then war broke out. Remember the Gulf
right.
War?
Yes.
And so they were all ready to make the show in 1991, and they said they had to funnel like $5 million that was earmarked for the comedy department into doing live crosses to the or coverage of the Gulf War. So they said, we're not going to be able to make this show for another year and a half. So we had a year and a half to prepare for The Late Show. So we just continued doing our breakfast show. Mick and I were also doing stand-up by that time. And then we did The Late Show for 2 years, and then we toured for a year, and then we did Martin Molloy. So there was a lot going on.
So let's get to the show itself. It was mayhem to listen to. I'm sure it would have been quite panicky and arduous behind the scenes. Best laid plans, Tony. What was one of the moments possibly where you had this golden idea, but maybe technology just wasn't on your side?
Oh, there was just so much elaborate production that you just needed more time. And I later did a show called Get This, mm-hmm. with a guy called Matt Dower, who's like an audio genius who I still work with to this day on a show called Sizzletown that we do on the internet. And I look at the equipment we're using now, and we can do something in an hour that would have taken 2 days to do on Martin Molloy. We spent a lot of time cutting up interviews. You know that technique where you take an interview, say, from the 7:30 report, yep. and then you chop up all the answers and you change all the questions. And and we would do things like we would take Pauline Hanson interviews and cut the sentences into song lyrics and put it to music. And that kind of thing takes so long to do when you're using a quarter-inch tape and a razor blade.
When cut and paste was cut and paste.
Yeah, whereas now you just move it around with a mouse. So that kind of stuff took so long. Like, you would spend 3 days on something that went a minute 50 and probably got played twice.
Your show was that big, or you guys were that big, I'm not sure which, that you knocked back to the kind of who's who of Hollywood. How did your your bosses take it, and how did the glitterati take it?
We were very lucky. I mean, the key to the success was that The Late Show had been such a huge success nationally that, you know, it wasn't, we didn't, I don't think people around the country saw us as a Melbourne show, so we didn't have that kind of backlash that you get, where it's, oh, Melbourne people. It was, oh, those people that we remember from the ABC. So the show rated really quickly, and if a show's rating on commercial radio, at least in those days, they just leave you alone. And our thing was, we were very snobby about it just being a comedy show. Like, if we had people coming on as guests, we wanted them to be funny and be part of the comedy. So, yeah, there was a lot of trouble, like, why won't you have Kylie Minogue on? And we're going, we just can't think of a way to make Kylie Minogue funny. I think we did have her on once, but we didn't have her on all the time. Whereas Dave Graney is someone we would have on regularly, because Dave, even though he's not a comedian, he just has a very funny attitude to things.
Yes.
I remember Dave Graney coming in one day, and he had found, on the way to the show, he had found a whole lot of Playboy magazines from the 1970s at a garage sale. So he just, on national radio on 54 stations, he just took us through Playboy magazine from the 1970s. Hilarious. Now, you know, nothing against Kylie Minogue, but she's not going to do that.
That is Graney-esque. There are many favourites that I can think of, including the likes of Shed World, where you hounded some poor bloke who was running that particular enterprise. How did the skit play out, Tony?
Well, I'm not a fan. I know they're really popular, but I'm not a fan of what they call gotcha calls.
Yeah.
I always side with the victim. They always seem very cruel to me. So we would try and think of calls we could do that weren't, that were still funny but weren't mean. So that one was, Mick Molloy challenged me to call Shed World, I can't remember, it's somewhere in New South Wales, and have a conversation with whoever answered the phone in which they would use the word shed precisely 20 times. Not 19, not 21. And it was incredibly suspenseful. Like Peter Grace, who was the producer of the show, was just going ding every time he said shed. And I think we got to 17. And then it was so contrived the way we got him to say shed. And then he just wouldn't say it for like 5 minutes. And so that's not, you know, it's a prank, but it's not a cruel prank.
It's a beautiful prank.
The guy doesn't feel like he's, you know, being made fun of. It was just ridiculous. I loved calling sex lines. Sorry, let's not use that line out of context. I would call up sex lines as an old, you know, the ads would say, we'll talk about anything.
Yes.
So I'd call up as an old guy going, don't you feel that Blue Heelers is getting later and later? It's starting at 7 minutes past the half hour. And just, I'd have really meandering conversations with people on the sex lines.
39 cents a minute.
Sexy.
You won three arias, the Brown Album, Poop Shoot, and Eat Your Peas, which says so much about the tone of the show.
I'm sorry about that. We only called the album Poop Shoot because we wanted to hear someone say it on the arias in a really serious voice.
And look, also too, I love the fact your own professional comedy vocation, your own professional writing life has continued to evolve. You mentioned Sizzletown. You also did Childproof, which essentially was a series of podcasts as a live performance, and not to mention books. I know that you've got a couple of screenplays as well in production or in...
I've decided to move into the only area I don't think I've worked in outside of ballet, which is stop-motion animation. I'm trying to get a stop-motion animation film made, but it's proving to be as slow as the process of stop-motion animation itself.
And as any intense relationship can be, there can be a big sort of falling out. What about you and Mick? Have you managed to cross paths? Have you managed to exchange roses or emails at least?
Well, we did have a very... It was on the front of the... It was on the front of the Herald Sun.
Gag duo split.
There was a picture of me and Mick facing each other, and there was a giant... dagger in between us. And yeah, that happened, well, I think 15 years ago. But Sam Pang, who interestingly is working with all of my comedy husbands. He works with Tom Gleisner on Haven't Been Paying Attention. He works with Mick on the front bar. And he works with Ed Cavalier, who is my last comedy partner.
Yeah, sneaky Sam.
But Sam wants to bring us back together in the style of, I don't know if you ever saw the famous footage where Frank Sinatra reunited Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
I have not, but I'll need to.
And one of them was really drunk, so that's how it's going to have to work.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Congratulations to you and to your confrere in that the big guy. It's been wonderful to catch up with you, and it's a real honour, Tony, to think that the Martin and Malloy that has been a delight for so many listeners and an inspiration for so many radio makers is now part of the National Film and Sound Archive. That is a real honour, and whatever else they take away from you, they can't take that from you.
No, thanks, David. It's just great to know that Blimpy the lactose intolerant cat has been preserved for all time.